Good day, friends, and welcome to the Hashtag Music and Love Lecture Series. We are thrilled to see so many of you here at the University of Tennessee at Martin. We can't wait to reach many more of you on our podcast. Today is our extreme pleasure to welcome NAFME immediate past president, Denise Odegaard. Denise Odegaard, NAFME immediate past president from 2018 to 2020, is currently the Fargo Public Schools Performing Arts Curriculum Specialist and taught orchestra for 35 years. National service includes board member for both the American String Teachers Association Board and the National Association for Music Education Board. While on the ASTA board, she was chair of the Committee on School Orchestra and Strings and received the ASTA citation for leadership twice. Odegaard authored Curriculum Writing 101, Assistance with Standards-Based Music Curriculum and Assessment Writing for Band, Choir, Orchestra, and General Music. Co-authored the ASTA Curriculum, edited Kaleidoscope, a collection of standards-based lesson plans for the K-7 general music classroom, and co-authored the ASTA Curriculum Assessment Companion eBook for String Music Educators. Welcome, Ms. Odegaard.
Great to be here, and it's good to see all of you again. I've seen you twice or three times today, so that's good. So we're going to talk about how to advocate for music education. What are some things that you can say to people to really strengthen the importance of music? And so the goals today, we're going to review some neuroscience research regarding the benefits of music. We're going to connect to ESSA, the new legislation. Well, it's actually 3 years old now, and why that's important to music education. We're going to talk about some scheduling options for music and how to think creatively and outside the box when we want to have access and equity for all students. Create long-range plans to add or enhance music education in your district, which is one of the things you're working on here. And then some resources for you. So we're going to start out with a little video on why music is important. It's a TED Talk.
Did you know that every time musicians pick up their instruments, there are fireworks going off all over their brain? On the outside, they may look calm and focused, reading the music and making the precise and practiced movements required. But inside their brains, there's a party going on. How do we know this? Well, in the last few decades, neuroscientists have made enormous breakthroughs in understanding how our brains work by monitoring them in real time with instruments like fMRI and PET scanners. When people are hooked up to these machines, tasks such as reading or doing math problems each have corresponding areas of the brain where activity can be observed. But when researchers got the participants to listen to music, they saw fireworks. Multiple areas of their brains were lighting up at once as they processed the sound, took it apart to understand elements like melody and rhythm, and then put it all back together into unified musical experience. And our brains do all this work in the split second between when we first hear the music and when our foot starts to tap along. But when scientists turn from observing the brains of music listeners to those of musicians, the little backyard fireworks became a jubilee. It turns out that while listening to music engages the brain in some pretty interesting activities, playing music is the brain's equivalent of a full body workout. The neuroscientists saw multiple areas of the brain light up, simultaneously processing different information in intricate, interrelated, and astonishingly fast sequences. But what is it about making music that sets the brain alight? The research is still fairly new, but neuroscientists have a pretty good idea. Playing a musical instrument engages practically every area of the brain at once, especially the visual, auditory, and motor cortices. And as with any other workout, disciplined, structured practice in playing music strengthens those brain functions, allowing us to apply that strength to other activities. The most obvious difference between listening to music and playing it is that the latter requires fine motor skills, which are controlled in both hemispheres of the brain. It also combines the linguistic and mathematical precision in which the left hemisphere is more involved with the novel and creative content that the right excels in. For these reasons, playing music has been found to increase the volume and activity in the brain's corpus callosum, the bridge between the two hemispheres, allowing messages to get across the brain faster and through more diverse routes. This may allow musicians to solve problems more effectively and creatively in both academic and social settings. Because making music also involves crafting and understanding its emotional content and message, musicians often have higher levels of executive function, a category of interlinked tasks that includes planning, strategizing, and attention to detail, and requires simultaneous analysis of both cognitive and emotional aspects. This ability also has an impact on how our memory systems work. And indeed, musicians exhibit enhanced memory functions, creating, storing, and retrieving memories more quickly and efficiently. Studies have found that musicians appear to use their highly connected brains to give each memory multiple tags, such as a conceptual tag, an emotional tag, an audio tag, and a contextual tag, like a good internet search engine. So how do we know that all these benefits are unique to music, as opposed to, say, sports or painting? Or could it be that people who go into music were already smarter to begin with? Neuroscientists have explored these issues, but so far they have found that the artistic and aesthetic aspects of learning to play a musical instrument are different from any other activity studied, including other arts. And several randomized studies of participants who showed the same levels of cognitive function and neural processing at the start found that those who were exposed to a period of music learning showed enhancement in multiple brain areas compared to the others. This recent research about the mental benefits of playing music has advanced our understanding of mental function, revealing the inner rhythms and complex interplay that make up the amazing orchestra of our brain.
We used to say music makes you smarter. Now we really have proof of that, and I don't know why we're not screaming that to the world, because this little video shows you exactly how, you know, music uses both sides of the brain, there's connections across both hemispheres, and how it then goes into all the other classes and other things that you do. So that's a great video to share with people who don't really understand the power of music and what it does for students and people. So to take this a little farther, benefits for speech and language, complex language functions. We know that kids probably can sing or play music at a young age, and when they learn music, it also helps them to do the other complex language functions that go on. Speech production, speech comprehension. Just go through these kind of quickly. Cognitive. Executive functioning, mental control, and self-regulation. I know today in the world, the young students in elementary school have a very difficult time with self-regulation. You're going to get kids with very little patience. They're easy to anger. And that's what some of the studies that are showing, that kids really need to learn this. And music is a place where they can do that, because you learn practice skills and put them together and work with other people, and so you have to be working all the time on what's going on with you and reacting to other people. Reasoning and problem solving, learning and spatial memory, motor skills, voluntary movement, motor control, coordination, balance, and motor memory. A lot of that just with playing an instrument you're going to get. Sensory, hearing, sight, touch, and other sensations. There's a few studies I'm going to go into now where people have actually been writing about this, and it's funny that people outside of music education are writing about some of these things. Some of the things you'll see are from administrators, and so there's a lot of benefits that people are starting to see. So this is a report called Social Emotional Benefits of the Arts, and this, I don't have all the information up here, but it's a great resource for you to go in and look at and share some of the social-emotional learning right now is real big, and if you happen to go to our NAPMI conference in the fall, we have a whole day-long session on social-emotional learning and music education. So some of the benefits of social-emotional learning and music: tolerance for other people's perspectives. We may have somebody that interprets music differently than another person. We have somebody that enjoys this kind of music and somebody enjoys that kind of music. So we learn to learn about each other and understand each other a little better. Awareness of and appreciation for other cultures. There's so many, music is really in every culture, and there's a reason it's still there after all these years. It's a part of the fabric of every person and where they come from. Perseverance, so the willingness to extend sustained effort in the pursuit of their goals. Practicing, making perfect what they're playing, or as perfect as they can be, is a skill. Again, kids today lose patience very quickly. And so we're teaching them the skills to take the time to learn something and do it better each time they do it. School engagement, involvement, and interest in school. The Harris poll, which I'll show you probably in a second, kids want to come to school because of the arts. And we know there not every student is going to fit into that perfect mold of what school is. Arts kids sometimes take a different path to where they want to go. And so therefore, that might be the only reason they come to school. Kids graduate because of the arts. They might drop out and have maybe go to an alternative school, get a GED or something like that, because they are not fitting into school. This is a growth mindset with music, because we're starting at one place, practicing, using strategies to get to that next place of as close to perfection as we can. Academic goal orientation, motivation to succeed in life. So if you're in music class and you're becoming successful because music teachers break things down and they learn steps and sequences of things, they start to feel confident, and that confidence spills over into all the other classes that they're taking, and they do better in school all around in all their subjects. Academic self-efficacy, believing in one's capabilities to succeed in school. Some kids come to school and they've been labeled a failure. The teacher calls them, you know, the goof-off who doesn't care about his grades or anything, and they don't know how to get out of that cycle of being labeled as something. And I think in music, we take those kids and we give them meaning to their life, and we give them success, and we care about them and who they are and who they become. And self-awareness. So this is a Harris poll taken several years ago, but they did prove that the graduation rate in a school without music was 72.9%. In a school where they had music, it was raised to 90%. And attendance rate went from 84% to 93% with music programs. So that's pretty significant gains. We know that throughout life, medical doctors right now are realizing there are so many benefits to music, and really about 66% of doctors were music majors, so they get this. But babies are born addicted to heroin at birth. They used to give them drugs, now they play music for them. Very much less invasive. We know from some, I don't know if you've ever watched any of the videos on YouTube, but Alzheimer's patients don't connect with anybody till they play some songs from when they probably were younger, and they actually are drawn out of wherever they are, and they communicate with the people around them. It's brief, but you can bring them back to be able to communicate. You can listen to music during surgery to reduce pain and help recovery. And the latest thing I found on the internet was Parkinson's patients shuffle and have a hard time walking on uneven steps, and they put on music and they just glide through the room. And all they did was put on music. So there's so many cool things that music does for us besides the things that we know about in the medical field now. So here's a couple of case studies. This is an inner city school in Bradford in West Yorkshire, England. They added 6 hours of music a week for every student. And the results were the school is now in the top 10% nationally for their pupil progress in reading, writing, and math. 74% of its kids met the nation's reading standard, higher than the national average of 53. The students are 7.1 points above the national average for reading and 3.4 above for writing. And there, it goes on and on about the results of what music has done for the kids. Not in music, but in other subjects. So what makes this achievement so remarkable is the fact that this school had everything against them before they started. They added music and the kids excelled. I get educational emails every day from all over the place, and this caught my eye one day. Principal fired security guards and invested in the arts program. So he took the money he paid security guards working with student behavior to having arts programs, and they found that they didn't have any more behavior issues. And so here's an interesting statement. The end result, Orchard Gardens has one of the fastest student improvement rates statewide, and the students once described as loud and unruly have found their focus. Very interesting to me. This is an article in the School Administrator, Why the Arts Belong in School. So now you have administrators buying into the arts, and we're starting to see this more and more, where they are coming and saying this is important. We can say all we want, but until they believe it and they help promote it, so that's a great resource if you're looking for, I don't have any more information on it, but it's a great thing to look up if you want some feedback from administrators. So ACT scores, 10 million responded to a survey about the number of years they took arts classes. So this was an add-on to the ACT test one year. With 10 million kids responding, we got some good feedback. Students who took arts classes had higher mathematics, verbal, and composite SAT scores than students who did not take the arts. This wasn't done by music people. This was done by ACT. The arts reach students who are not otherwise being reached. Arts sometimes prove it's the only reason they go to school. We've talked about that. Music helps with different learning styles. It raises that student concept and their successful learning in other areas. We've already mentioned that. Great place to go express yourself. Kids don't have, they used to be in elementary school, you'd have three recesses a day, you'd go outside and get all your pent-up emotions worn off a little bit. Now kids have probably 10 minutes of recess a day in a lot of places. And so it's a place to just go express yourself and get rid of some of those emotions that you're feeling. Relationships, I think kids in music classes, you'll find that their attitudes towards one another improve through music class because we're teaching tolerance. We have to work together, so how do you make that happen? And so I think kids are much more tolerant when they've gone through music classes. They scored higher in creativity and several measures of academic self-concept than students without that level of arts instruction in arts-rich schools. Gifted and talented kids, music is a great place to challenge them. We've talked about that a couple of times today. They may excel in music, and you have to take them to the next level. So it's really unlimited. Take the roof off and they can do anything that you ask them to do, and they will. So don't ever feel like you can limit what your kids do. And I was working with our model cornerstone assessments, and a teacher taught the assessment we had written, and she said at the end of it, I haven't asked my students to do enough. And so I think we forget how much kids can really do. The world of work. Students create works of arts. They see how parts relate to another. Whether it be small changes in color or language, they're all tuned into that because of working with the arts. And then practicing future workplace behaviors. They've been called soft skills, but a slide later here talks about Google doesn't call them soft skills, they're hard skills, because all those things that music teaches kids, those 21st century skills, cooperation, creativity, that's what workplaces are looking for. They don't want a degree anymore. They want somebody they can train the way they want to train them to do the job that they're doing. So they've been called soft skills, but I think now they're really concrete skills that we're looking for. Autism intervention. Kids that studied music had significant gains in both neurological activation and adaptive behavior associated with social-emotional functioning. Another research project, we all know choral singing calms your heart, releases endorphins, boosts your mood, self-esteem, alleviates feelings of stress and depression, and a sense of belonging. So these are all studies that you could bring to the table if you ever had to advocate for music. This is the one on Google. 21st century skills. The top characteristics of success at Google are all soft skills, which also comes out of music education. So being a good coach, communicating and listening well, possessing insights into others, including others that have different values and points of view, having empathy toward and being supportive of one's colleagues, and being a good critical thinker and problem solver, and being able to make connections across complex ideas. And I think if you could go to a job with all those skills from music, you could. I mean, they're looking actually for music majors in a lot of businesses because they know that that's where those skills come from. I showed some of you this chart before, 21st century skills and how it relates to music. And we have critical thinking, so a couple of them under here. Critical thinking, transferring learning to unknown pieces of music. So you learn about a certain rhythm and you can go to another piece of music you've never seen before and actually play it. Collaboration, making each student personally responsible for their own portion of the music. Execution, and then making it fit well with the performance of others. So you're always adapting to those around you. Communication, performing literature that has a message that we want to share with ourselves and our audiences that are relevant to the world around us, especially choral. You have lyrics and you can really get messages out, or there are compositions that have been specifically written by composers for a certain happening, like 9/11 or something like that, which makes people think, gives people something to discuss, and helps people understand the world basically through music. Creativity, creating music uses both sides of the brain, the mathematical side and the emotional side. Students are encouraged to try new ideas and take risks that are out of the box. Every moment of music requires thousands of creative decisions to be made and even more so executed. So these are things my teachers had come up with, and it was kind of fun to read all the things that they came up with. I just covered all that. So let's get to Every Student Succeeds Act, which came out in December of 2015. And the gentleman you see in front right here, I got my little, this is Lamar Alexander, and he's from where?
Tennessee.
Right. And it was very important to him to get this bipartisan legislation. So both the Democrats and Republicans agreed on this. And that was probably one of the few things that they could actually get done. You know, there's the separation now, fighting between Democrats and Republicans, and you're wrong, we're right, and we're not going to help you, and you're not going to help us. And so that was kind of an amazing day when that passed. And NAFME had a big part in this. As you'll see in the next slide, this is what the language, it lists all the subjects up there, it lists the arts, and then you see music right here, listed by itself. We worked very hard to get music put into there so that we could make sure this was on the top of people's minds as they read this legislation. We have an advocacy leadership force person in each state who then works with the state legislation to make sure that we keep the language in there for music, and we keep music supported. And now we have to bring it down. We've done the national, we've done the state. Now we have to make sure teachers know how to advocate for music education, which is part of what we're talking about today. So something you might want to think about if you go into teaching is sometimes you have to go to professional development that the whole school has to go to, reading, language arts, but there are monies in Title IIA for professional development that could be used strictly for music people. So in our district, we have teachers that can attend their state conference. The school district will pay for subs and registration through this money. If you want to have a guest person come in on a PD day and give you music training, tap into this money, and I don't think a lot of people know that that's out there and available. Title 4A is about the well-rounded part of this ESSA legislation, and it's not well-rounded like I am, but it's well-rounded. It's not just dealing with language arts and math, it's dealing with education technology, safe and health for healthy students. And then the third part of this is well-rounded education. So that is where music is included in the well-rounded education, and it's funded annually by each state to each district through these titles and different parts of the funding. And then the funds are spent at the district level, not each individual school. This is really to help serve disadvantaged students, including providing access to well-rounded education subjects, which includes music and arts. So when you have a community that has sporadic music and access to music, it's not equitable across that district or that county district, And so what you want to do is take this Title IV language and share with them that music is part of this. And so that's going to give you some good background for support for that. Because I don't know that a lot of administrators are looking at all the different subjects that are in there, and if they did, they would probably then realize music is a part of this new legislation. So each district has to do a needs assessment, so they look at what needs to be improved or have access to. So every year they do a needs assessment, so that's something you want to tap into too for what you're doing. If there's lacking, like no music, then you would say this is a need we have. Now granted, everybody's in this one bucket of money trying to get parts of it, but if you can just get a little bit of it each year and keep building that program over time, that's going to be beneficial. NAFME has opportunity to learn standards. So when you're teaching in a district and you don't think your equipment is up to speed, your scheduling isn't working the way you want it to, the frequency of when your kids have class, the length of the class period, this is a document found on our website that will go into what do we say is a basic level and a quality level program. So you can go through a checklist and actually determine how many of your things are in a basic level and how many are in the quality level. And that's another way too to prove that here's the national standard, here's where we're at. So it's a great activity to do with your administrators. So it's in the areas of curriculum and scheduling, staffing, materials and equipment, and facilities, and in checklist form. So we have a lot of different ways to teach music, and I think one of the things we're trying to do at NAFME is to really think about how we can reach the kids that we're not reaching. In reality, we probably reach about 20% of the kids in high school in our music programs. That means there's 80% of the kids left over that aren't participating in music for some reason. Now they might be doing garage bands, hip hop music, anything outside of school, but they don't see that happening in school. So either how do we incorporate those into our classes, rap, hip hop, gospel singing, any of that into our classes, or how do we just have a class that's more meaningful? Like we were talking at dinner tonight, bluegrass groups instead of a formalized band program in certain areas. Some areas you had Marsha Neal here who said mariachi, you know, was very typical and traditional for where she grew up. Now where I live in North Dakota, that's probably not going to fly, but we have other kinds of music, you know, from our culture. So when you look at all the variety of ways we can reach kids either in our class or bring kids into music, that's what we really have to think about. Here's an example, an iPad band. We're seeing more and more of that. There's going to be a session on that at our conference next year. You guys ever tried that here? You should try it. Playing with his fingers on an iPad. There's another alternative. This is a friend of mine who does a steel drum band in California, and I want you to notice how much fun they're having. On podcast, you can't notice this, but these kids are bobbing around and just having a fantastic time. They compose a lot of their own music. and they've played a lot of different places. So. I'm not going to play it all, but did you notice how much joy was emoted through that performance? And we want kids to love music, and we want them to love music for life. And how many kids put away their instrument after high school and never play again? I mean, you all are not those people. But think of how many kids go through the music program, and then, you know, if they have a community group that's an audition group, and they're not good enough to get into that, then there's no place for them to play. So here's all the different ways, not all the different ways, but some of the different ways that we can look at how music happens in our schools. I know in a lot of large city urban schools, they may have eclectic ensembles for their classes. They might have a rock band, they might have gospel choirs, they might have some of the things that we don't see in more of the suburban areas. And so the sky's really the limit. What do you want it to look like? And maybe you want to have, some people have like steel drum band for, in band class, they'll have steel drum band for maybe a quarter. So the kids all play a steel drum for one quarter, even though they play flute and clarinet, saxophone, and the more traditional instruments. So looking at continuity across a district, in the larger city urban areas, a lot of times it will be site-based manage, which means the principal is in charge of what goes on in that school. They're in charge of the budget for that school. And they may decide to have music. The next elementary school decides they don't want music because they want to put their money into the testing areas. And so you have all those elementaries with the, either a music program or not, feeding into a middle school. And how do you make that program work when you have beginners and non-beginners? And then that feeds into a high school. And again, you have some of that going on in the area. And so how do we make it, how do we make access to music available for all kids, and how do we make it equitable? In my district, we provide instruments for all the kids that have financial need. And so each year, I think we have about 1,500 instruments in our inventory, and each year there's more and more kids that have an instrument that they don't have. We usually have a rental program, but in this case, they don't even have to pay that $90 a year. They just have to show up and they can play, which is really nice. Elementary usually has general music, band, choir, orchestra, hand chimes. We even have a folk dance group in our, it's a co-curricular group. Middle school, band, orchestra, choir, jazz band, and any other kind of music you can think of. The hard part is scheduling it, trying to find time in the day, making time in the day, making it a priority, getting that parent support to help make some of those decisions. So let's talk about some barriers to music education. The cost for instruments is a barrier. Even the $90 a year is a barrier for some. Even getting to early rehearsals, if they don't take the bus and the bus doesn't get there, barriers to get to rehearsals. So for instance, we have a low-income school that has, all of our schools have an orchestra program, and when they have a concert at night, we actually just keep them at school, feed them pizza, and their parents join them. Otherwise, we would never get the kids back to go to the concert. And so we got to think of ways to make things easy for the kids that really struggle with transportation, being able to afford. And sometimes we see the instruments disappear. One time we found a bass in a pawn shop. And I mean, that's kind of a big one to hide. Sometimes the neighbors don't like you practicing your tuba in the middle of the night, and I think that apartment got broken into and the tuba disappeared, but they left the case. So I mean, we have those kinds of things that happen, and sometimes a kid leaves the school, like town, in the middle of the night because they're running from some kind of debt collector or something, or fearing for their lives sometimes with abuse, and the instrument goes with them, we never see them again. But it's maybe one, maybe two instruments a year. So I mean, that's worth it to us to to provide for them. And then music is not representative of students attending school, so trying new classes, as we talked about. And then students with special needs. We have music classes for all of our kids with special needs. They can be in any instrumental choir program, but in general music, we have an adaptive music class at every level, elementary, middle school, high school. And then opposite, they have adaptive PE, so they get experiences too. We had a teacher who did the Wizard of Oz with his adaptive music class, and the tears were just streaming down the parents' faces because they've never been able to have their kids do something like other kids in the school. It's really cool. Scheduling considerations, and we've talked about this a little bit today with my meetings with Angela. I mean, this is Andrew. think creatively. I mean, it is hard to schedule. So some of the things that we've done for our high school, if the high school teachers have 0 to 39 kids in their class, they are paid 20%, because that's pretty close to what other teachers teach. If they have 40 to 59 students, they get paid 30%. If they have 60 or more students, they get paid 30%, plus they have an assistant who gets paid 10% because it's every other day. And then my teachers get resource time. 20% of their job is resource time, which is teaching private lessons to students during their study halls. And sometimes that happens after school, sometimes it happens before. We have some classes at 0 hour because a lot of music kids take a lot of AP classes. So we'll have jazz band and, before school at some schools. We'll have chamber orchestra Monday nights at some schools. And that really helps music kids who like to take everything, and they're smart and they want to take AP classes. The hard part is avoid scheduling opposite of other singleton classes like foreign languages and those AP classes. So sometimes we have kids that want to be in orchestra or band or choir, and they can't because they're taking an AP class. And so we just have to kind of work around those things. Sometimes our administrators will just take a student and schedule, kind of hand schedule that student so they can take as much of the courses that they want to. So they've been really good about that. And then consider scheduling music first in the schedule so you avoid some of those pitfalls. And then it makes, and then everything else falls into place. Where if you try to put music in last, it's kind of like shoving a square peg into a round hole. Block scheduling happens in some places. So again, those scheduling conflicts with AP classes and electives, we want to make sure we maintain student enrollment because block scheduling has less classes perhaps offered, or they're offered in a creative way. Sometimes they're skinny, they're called skinnies, so you have a long class and then there's two skinnies that can plug into that one long class, so music can be one of those. Sometimes teachers will have a group that'll change at semester time, so then you get into instrumentation balance issues. Traveling music teachers are hard to fit into block scheduling. And then we want students to be allowed to be a choir and band or choir and orchestra. And in our district, we really tried to maintain that. So we schedule orchestra and band at the same time, and then two choir classes so they can take. And again, it's how many numbers you have in your school, too. I mean, if it's a small school, that makes it difficult. But in the larger schools, that's a good way to think about it, so kids can take both. We get kids that think, I can take it for a semester and drop. Well, we're trying to change that attitude. So we're trying to use language like music is a year-long class, and you need to continue through the whole year. And a lot of times in middle school, it's that little hump to get them over, and then they're interested the rest of their, you know, middle school and high school. So if you can get them over that hump, they'll be good to go for a long time. Age-appropriate length of class. We have, for our kindergarten and first grade students, they have 20 minutes of music every day. 3, 4, 5 has 40 minutes every other day. So it's a lot more transitioning for kindergarten and first grade. But it's the repetition and how often that really helps those younger kids. Sometimes, if you can allow the music kids to register for classes first, I don't know if that's possible, but that might be something that might help. And then alternating blocks on A, B days, so you have many more things, many more class periods to pick from. We have gone from, I think, a nine-hour class day at our high school to 8 hours. And that eighth hour is really tough to have music in because people want to go to sports or they want to do their job or something else. So try, I know it's hard to avoid scheduling last in the day, but sometimes you don't have a choice. And sometimes you get more kids because you schedule the last period of the day. Middle school and high school consideration. Middle school, large group only. Sometimes you have to split that group if it's too large, if you're in a big school district. And we've come up with some numbers for where to split those. So around 60 kids in a band or choir, we split at 60 because after that it just gets to be a monster of a group. And you're not giving attention. Or if you had an assistant go in at 60, that's what we do. If we have a group of 60, we have an assistant then assigned to that group. Just managing kids. I mean, if you have a kid that breaks a string or it breaks a reed, you know, that can sidewall class for a long time. Orchestra, we split around 50 because of the tuning issue. And then we have, our middle schools have turned from two grade levels, I think. In some cases, like the school I taught at was 8th and 9th grade, and another middle school had 7th and 8th grade. I don't know, there was all sorts of configurations. And then they turned them all into middle school, 6, 7, and 8, and we didn't have the space. We have like instrument sectionals every other day and large groups every third day. And so we don't have the space for all those sectionals happening, and so we have people teaching in practice rooms. We have a guy that has... the left side of the stage, the theater, is his classroom, and so we've had to be really creative. But now as we schedule for next year, we're told we can't hire anybody else, and we don't have the space to put 16 kids in a room when it fits 12. So those are all the things you have to consider is your space, and then the acoustics are bad in a small space with 10 clarinets. I mean, so there's a lot of issues we have to deal with being music. I just talked about that. Continuity is key in a sequential music program. So if you have, like I said before, a school that has an elementary school that has music and then the next one doesn't, and feeding into a program where they're supposed to all fit together into one group is really tough. Let's see what next. Budget considerations. Choirs. As a music teacher, sometimes you've had teachers that will play the piano and conduct choir, it's really beneficial to be able to hire an accompanist to come in. They don't come in every day, they might come in once a week, but we have a budget to pay accompanists $25 an hour, and we wanted to pay them enough to make it worth their time because a lot of them have three or four part-time jobs, and if we pay them like after-school pay of $11, it's not really worth it to them, so our administration has listened to us on that. You need a music and supply budget, and copyright issue is a huge thing. You don't want to, if you don't have money to buy music and you go copy it, that's illegal, and you don't want to do that. And so many years ago when we decided that we didn't want to play that game of the copyright issue, they added to our budget to purchase real music. Right now in our state contests, they used to allow us to make one copy of a page for a page turn, and that's really illegal too, so they cracked down on that. We're adding money to our budget to be able to buy two books of a solo so that page turn can happen. So you want to consider copyright. You also have pianos you have to keep in tune, and there's nothing worse than going into a music classroom and hearing the out-of-tune piano and trying to have a choir sing with it or at a concert. Heaven forbid. So best time to tune pianos if you are in a location where you put heat on in the fall and winter. You want to tune them after the heat's on for a while. But, you know, get them tuned before a concert happens, and hopefully you can work that into the budget. Here's another one. Paying for good quality instruments. You probably want to have less instruments but better quality because over time they're going to cost you less money. You get instruments that aren't quality, you're going to be repairing them every year. And so think about that. If you're having to put together some kind of 3 to 5 year plan, you want to get good instruments that are going to last over time, and then you can actually get more instruments instead of just paying for repairs. Provide for students in need, we've talked about. Keep track of your inventory. Students instance, like I said, are transient. They move from one place to the other. They take that instrument with you, and if you don't keep track of what you have, you're pretty soon going to have a low inventory of instruments. So, big ticket items, coral risers, sound shells, stand and chair carts, instrument storage, they all cost money. I put into the budget every year those big ticket items that we need. Sometimes at the end of the year, the school district has money. Like in my district, she said, well, what do you need that's big items? And then she says, well, let's see if we can buy those. Because they have to spend the money each year in order to make that budget work the next year. So that's a great time to ask for that, is at the end of the year. Pay-to-play programs really are basically, if you can afford an instrument, you can play. That has real big issues with access and equity. Another thing that we've worked hard in our district is some school districts have so many activities that kids want to be, music kids especially, want to be in all of them. And so if you have a concert and the kid has a practice for a game, how do you make them come to your concert when they really want to be at that practice? So we came up with this little chart. So if it's a concert versus a practice, the student goes to the concert. And everybody's clear about this. It's in the activities handbook. The parents know about it. The kids know about it. The administration knows about it. The high schools have three designated concerts that the kids need to attend. And then whatever extra concerts they have, then the kids could have a choice. Performance dress rehearsal versus practice, that's the student's decision because it's neither a game nor a performance. Performance, dress rehearsal versus game, they would go to the game. Concert versus regional or state competition, the student attends the competition. And sometimes you have competitions happening at the same time. A music competition happens at the same time as the state baseball tournament or something. So the biggest thing is not to put students in a position where you make them feel uncomfortable. And sometimes on the other end of the other activity, they're being put pressure upon, like, you need to come to this practice or you're not going to play the game. Or you need to be at play practice or you're not going to be able to do this or whatever. And I had a girl one time that was the star hockey player. And she was my concert mistress in my orchestra. And her games always fell on a night of my concerts. So we sat down and mapped it out. And I said, you're going to go to the game here, come to my concert here, go to the game there. So we alternated, but never put that kid in the middle to have to decide. It's a very bad position, and it only makes you look bad. So how can you give a little? Sometimes you're not going to get that on the other end. They're just going to take all they can get, which is unfortunate. But what is a student going to learn from what you did because it was better for them? How much more time do I have?
You could take 10 minutes.
That
seems
okay.
Good with you all.
Yeah. I think I just have a little bit left. Okay. How do you start a program from scratch? And so one of the things, I helped with an orchestra program in Arizona. We started it from scratch. There's a lot of kids in the community that took lessons, private lessons. There was an area youth symphony, but there was no program, orchestra program in the community. So we started, this is kind of a chart of how we mapped it out. The first year we wanted to infiltrate a lot of beginners, so we started fourth and fifth grade students both in orchestra and combined those classes, so we had some large numbers. The middle school had one class because of kids that took in the community, and then the high school we didn't do anything yet. The second year we separated fourth and fifth grade orchestra, and the fifth graders that had started the year before now need an orchestra class. So now they have a sixth grade class plus that other class of anybody that already knows how to play. And then we started a multi-level class at the high school for those kids that had started outside of school and could play. And then we added a seventh grade orchestra and one sixth grade through eighth grade class of those players who had already played before. So you see that the different leveling, and it's much more manageable for a school district to come with a plan like this and add a little bit each year than to say, boom, we want this whole thing at once. So consider that when you're looking for what you need. So we finally ended up with fourth and fifth grade, a sixth, seventh, and eighth grade orchestra. Sometimes they're all put into one orchestra or one group, and that's really hard to manage with abilities. from 6th through 8th grade, and then they had a 9th grade group, a 10th grade group, and a 9th through 12th grade audition group. So by the end of year 6, which would be 4 years from now, they're going to have all that in place. So what can your school board do for you? There's written policies that they can really look at to make sure there's access and equity to music and the arts. They can support the development of plans to strengthen your arts program and then allocate resources. And your parents are your best allies for helping you get the things you need. You can't go to the school board and say, I need this. The parents have to do it for you. So remember that, because I know you're passionate and you want to go do this, but it's the parents that are going to do it. And the parents, seeing that parent support is really big for a school district to see. And then treat arts education equally with other subjects. And so if more money is pumped into another area and you're not getting any kind of funding or your funding hasn't increased in many years, always articulate what you need. Don't compare yourself to another subject area or sports, because you are completely different from that group and you can't compare apples to oranges. So always advocate for what you need and not what anybody else has and you don't have. And then consider the artistic qualities of the buildings and the needs of arts programs during facility renovation and development. We had our superintendent come to a middle school during passing time. He about got run over. There were so many kids in that little wing. And again, like I said, they used practice rooms to teach in, and they had a band room, an orchestra room, a choir room, and the stage. And all those kids came flooding out at him. And he's like, oh man, we need to add space, because he actually saw it happen. And so invite administrators to see if you have a need for space, what's going on, like how many kids are stuffed in a room of, you know, that holds 20 and you have 40 kids stuffed in there. They have to physically see that, and that's when they make the decisions to make changes. So a superintendent that's supportive of the arts regularly articulates in writing memos and speeches. The last superintendent I had always bragged, we are one of those many communities that are best communities for school for music education that NAM gives awards to. And so we've had that award like 16 years, and he used that in many, like his opening speech many times for our district, to when all the teachers come back to school and we're all together. And they're proud of that. And so even if you can feed the administrator things, like, you always have to share the successes of what you're doing, because hopefully they will use it and support you that way. They can point to highly effective district-wide arts coordinators, and those are very few and far between, but that's, if you have a larger district, that's good to have. And then develop a shared understanding with district arts coordinators about the role of arts education. How is that benefiting the district? What does it look like? Encourage education staff to collaborate among disciplines to ensure that the district-wide initiatives apply to and include the arts. In our strategic plan, the last one we had in our district, there were 7 points, and the 7th point was the arts. And now we've done a new strategic plan, and they have called it STEAM, kind of rolling us in. And we're not really STEAM, because we don't it's not arts integration, but at least we're in there, so we're happy about that. And then having them attend arts events, invite them and your school board members to concerts. I mean, I'm amazed at how many of our school board people go to concerts and they love it, and then they know exactly what the program is like. And parents, what can they do? Principals told researchers that parents who never come to school for parent-teacher conferences will come to see their child perform in a concert or something that you have that involves the arts, and they can use that data of parents coming to those events in their parent engagement. They have to actually put data into their ESSA plan on parent engagement. So you're going to be benefiting the school district by having concerts and parents coming.
I hope you enjoyed listening to Ms. Odegaard this week as much as I did, and we would like to thank the UTM Music Department for making this episode possible. Hashtag Music Ed Love would also like to thank each and every one of you for tuning in, and we hope you'll subscribe and share this podcast today. We hope that this week you will all be able to sprinkle a little stardust on all your students, uncover the greatness within a few more humans, and send those stars through the stratosphere. Happy music and friends.